الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. Peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amen. Today we have our 11th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of productivity and production in Islam, looking at contributions of Muslims to various fields. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me as usual on the program Dr. Jamal Battery of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
We always take a few minutes at the beginning of our programs to go back and highlight the main points that we touched on in our previous program. Could I have you do that for us very quickly?
Sure. In the 10th program, we looked briefly into the contributions of Muslims to geography and how that was encouraged by the various teaching of Islam, like prayers, fasting, and pilgrimage, which necessitated some knowledge of geography. And we discussed the contribution of Muslims to the discovery of the New World, and we said that even if Muslims did not come to the Americas before Columbus, which is possible, at least they contributed the use of the compass. We talked also about their discovery that the Earth was a sphere or round as early as the 9th century, and measuring their circumference, and very accurate, very close to what we have today. We mentioned also that their works and maps for several centuries remained as the primary authoritative source on the subject for both in Europe and other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked briefly into some other applied areas like agriculture and the way Muslims introduced a variety of fruits and other plants, the improvement of irrigation methods. In manufacturing, we discussed the brilliance in particular areas such as textile of various types, leather, as well as the paper manufacturing, which was related to, of course, the spread of science and learning. And finally, the development in trade and the very sophisticated banking system that they had quite early in history before the West has known these various techniques.
Mm-hmm. Well, now in several of our last programs, we've been concerning ourselves principally with the contribution of Muslims to the field of science. Mm-hmm. I'd like to move away from the field of science and examine some contributions in some of the other fields. And I wonder,
sure,
perhaps I could ask you, first of all, if you would give some indication of contributions in the area of political science and sociology.
Well, on political science, we find that as early as the first part of the 10th century, a famous writer by the name of Al-Farabi wrote a book about the ideal city, if you will. And as Haider Bamit in Muslim Contribution to Civilization summarized it, he say that he perceived of a perfectly organized state as one which assures all its citizens perfect government and happiness after death. This is a very noble type of thought. But on a more practical level, beyond this normative type of theoretical desirable situation, a very famous book was written by Al-Mawardi. I happen to be fortunate enough to have a copy of it. Al-Mawardi lived in the late part of the 10th century and early 11th century. It's called Al-Ahkam al-Sultaniya, roughly something like Book of Rules of Power.
Mm-hmm.
In which Al-Mawardi did not only concern himself merely with the discussion of the theory or political theory of caliphate, the system of government in Islam, but he went even beyond that to discuss the variety of political, social, and legal institution in that state and how they operate in a correctly perceived and applied Islamic state. On the subject of sociology, perhaps the most famous sociologist perhaps in the world, mm-hmm, par excellence, is Ibn Khaldun, who lived in the in the later part of the 14th century, and just a few years in the early 15th century. Jack Reisler, in his book Arab Civilization, which was written in French, in fact, considers Ibn Khaldun as one of the greatest historians of all times. His book was a sort of representation of the first time somebody wrote about not just history, but philosophy of history, combining both comprehensiveness and philosophical reflections on history. For a long time, or for quite a bit of time before the modern sociology developed, we find that Ibn Khaldun made a very careful study of human society. How did human society evolve? What kind of explanation can be offered to explain the progress of history? In his famous book, Al-Muqaddimah, of which I have a copy also that I showed in a previous program, one can find some deep reflections on history, some examination of civilization, how the different types of living, nomadic or settled life, affect the thinking and attitudes of people. How does it affect the kind of industries, learning, that might be more prominent in a given civilization? It's really an interesting book. Many writers also refer to him as perhaps a father of economics too, because in the area of economics, long before Adam Smith, he said something really interesting. He said that the state should act as a trader, and that means that whatever revenue the government gets by way of taxation should be put back in circulation as soon as possible, just like a trader tries to use his income. He also advocated the lowering of taxes and making it reasonable, moderate, in order to encourage the individual incentive for productivity, to encourage entrepreneurial type of activities. He went in discussing also the various monopolies and what is the role of government. You see, it sounds like talking about modern economics, really. What is the role of government in that respect? One of his interesting remarks is that the wealth of the nation is really basically in its human resources. Or he used the term population, but that's the modern term we use now, is management of human resources, for example. So he was really amazing in terms of the kind of philosophical reflection that he made, which would relate both to, you know, philosophy of history and to the question that you're raising also, sociology. No wonder I recollect reading a statement made by the famous British historian Arnold Toynbee. He said that perhaps he is the greatest historian who ever lived in terms of his reflection and contributions.
Right. Well, we know that much of what we know of the history of certain parts of the globe we owe to the contributions that have been made by Islamic historians. You've just made some comment about prominent historians. I wonder if perhaps I could have you expand a little bit more in terms of the contributions to the field of history that have been made by Muslims. Sure.
The contribution does not just begin with Ibn Khaldun. I just mentioned Ibn Khaldun because of his philosophy of history type of emphasis. But as early as the early part of the 8th century, we find many Muslim historians who excelled, like Urwa ibn Zubair, Wahb ibn Munabbih, and the famous historian Ibn Ishaq, who wrote about the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Many of these historians seem to have been more interested in the preservation and recording of facts and events without the application of too much of interpretation or judgment, an attitude which emerged later on among Western historians. However, this is too much of a generalization, because many of the Muslim historians also showed a great deal of critical judgment in their approach. Among the most famous historians in Islamic literature are people like At-Tabari, who lived in the later part of the 9th century. He wrote a universal chronicle, which is regarded as a most brilliant work. Al-Mas'udi, about the same period also, who was both a geographer, we mentioned him previously, he was also a historian, and he wrote a vast work called Akhbar al-Zaman, like History of the World, composed of 20 big volumes, but unfortunately these were lost and ruined in history. Ibn Miskawi, who lived perhaps in the later part of the 10th century, because he died in the early part of the 11th century, wrote about the experience of nations, Tajarib al-Umam, and his attention was directed to the political, philosophical and economic, political philosophy and economic problems of people. Among the most famous also, whose works are still available, is Ibn al-Athir, who lived in the first half of the 13th century. He wrote also a universal chronicle of the world, covering up to his own time, from the beginning of creation until 1231. According to George Sarton, he considers Ibn al-Athir as one of the best historians of the medieval times, or Middle Ages so-called, and he describes him as being far ahead of his contemporaries, whether in the Muslim world or elsewhere. Al-Makkari, who died in the 17th century, wrote quite extensively about Muslims in Spain, in Muslim Spain, and the intense intellectual activities in the day-to-day life during this glorious period. And these are only few examples of the magnitude of contribution to this field. In fact, the science of biology, the science of biography, I should say, has been actually introduced by Muslims through their meticulous research about the verification of the saying of the Prophet.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, oftentimes I've encountered many people who have visited the Muslim world, and they've been very much fascinated with the art and the architecture that they find there. Examples would be the Blue Mosque in Turkey, I believe, the Taj Mahal in India. Could you perhaps comment on the contributions in this area?
Well, it is interesting to notice that in the area of art and architecture, there is a combination of diversity and unity. Of course, with the vast, or the vastness of the Muslim world and the variety of Muslim countries in every continent from all backgrounds and cultures, you may see some measure of diversity, which shows that Muslims did not go to destroy cultures that existed, but rather to cause some kind of fusion and closeness and purify cultures perhaps from some of the things which are contrary to the teaching of Islam, but not really destroy the culture as such. So there is some diversity because of this background in different areas. However, it is interesting to notice also that there is a basic unity in art and architecture, wherever you go, which is definitely influenced by the teaching of Islam. Unfortunately, many of these monuments have been totally destroyed, like, for example, Baghdad, which is now in Iraq. After the Hulagu Mongols invasion, many of these great monuments were totally destroyed. That was in 1258. In Spain also, the city of Az-Zahra, which was all totally finished. I mean, there is no trace of it, as far as I know, at the present time. However, we can still, until now, even see some reflection of this great progress in architecture. We can see that, for example, in Spain, in Alhambra and Alcazar, in Seville, the influence of Islamic architecture moved to Europe through a variety of ways, or through different gates. It went through Spain, it went through Sicily to Italy, it also penetrated France through Septimania, because Muslims, as you know, reached France also, southern France, and ruled for quite some time. Until now, we still can find some remains of the mosaic in the Islamic pattern, which is found even in many churches in Auvergne, which is a province in mid-France.
Yes.
The effect or influence of the design of the mosque of Cordova in Spain seemed to have had a great influence on the Notre Dame de Puy, P-U-Y, and the various arches there architects would realize, of course, these terms like trefoil arcs, multi-lobal arcs, horseshoe type of arcs are all analogous in these churches to the design that is in the Cordoba mosque. One of the most fascinating things that it is said that on one of the doors on the cathedral of Puy, there is a decoration there with Arabic inscriptions saying Masha'Allah. Masha'Allah, which is the Muslim term, something like it is the will of God or something of that sort. That's the Arabic term of it. Even in the British Museum, there is a cross, an Irish cross that dates back to the 9th century. And ironically, in the middle of that cross, it says Bismillah, in the name of Allah. Which is an interesting reflection that even in religious objects, the influence of Islamic architecture has been so manifest and so clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, from our discussions in these last several programs, it would seem that there was a very keen interest in learning in the Islamic community. A claim has been made sometimes that when Muslims conquered Egypt, they were responsible for burning the famous library at Alexandria. Is there any truth to that suggestion?
Not really. That's an old story now that many historians feel it doesn't have too much credibility, neither on historical grounds nor on logical grounds. Let me refer you to, for example, one of the most respected non-Muslim historians, George Sarton, in his Introduction to the History of Science. And in volume 1, on page 466, he says about that story, and I quote, "This story is entirely unproved. The first mention of it occurs only after an interval of 6 centuries. So in the first mention, 6 centuries after the alleged burning. In the account of Egypt written by Abdul Latif in the first half of the 13th century, moreover, to prove that the Muslim destroyed that famous library, it would be necessary first to prove that it still existed in the 7th century. And this is really very doubtful," that's his term, "very doubtful. It is very probable that a good part of it had been destroyed by the Christians many centuries before." So in terms of historicity of the matters, and there are lots of more evidence, and it's a topic by itself, I mean, there are lots of additional evidence that this historically is not correct. But what even gives credence to this kind of doubt raised about the story is that, logically speaking, why should Muslims do that while we have seen immense interest in learning over hundreds of years and the respect that was accorded to science, learning, and scientists, including, as you find in many references written by non-Muslims, the kind of tolerance that was shown to scientists from all walks of life, from all religious backgrounds. They find refuge and protection under Islamic rules. In fact, the libraries were, you might say, the jewels of Islamic civilization, not to be burned, but to be benefited from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to turn now to some discussion of those libraries and ask you if you could give us a description of what some overview of what libraries, were like.
Okay, well, these libraries were basically of two types, private and public. The private libraries were quite common and quite widespread, and many historians say that there was hardly any famous scientist or scholar who did not have his own personal library. Some of them has multi-thousand type of volumes, 10,000 more or less. Public libraries, however, were mostly attached to mosques, places of worship, or big schools, major schools. And if you look at the description, it's very difficult to distinguish actually between them and these libraries and today's libraries, and they have something extra even you don't find even in today's libraries.
Yes.
Description, for example, that they had the different rooms or halls, each one allocated for one subject. Mm-hmm. In terms of classification, that they had the shelves on the wall where the books are placed, and that they have special rooms for reading, rooms for copying, that they were full-time people sometimes copying to make more copies of the same references, that they had rooms even allocated for food and places for sleeping, especially for scholars who traveled from faraway places to come.
Yes.
And that also shows that there were apparently some contributions or charity paid to sustain those libraries, to help students of learning who might not be able to afford the food and accommodation, which is something that we don't find today. Many historians even say that in many of these libraries there were also free supplies of ink, paper, and pens. Some of this library was so huge that even by today's criteria, where printing has become so popular and so widespread, they were still quite huge. Let me give you a few examples of the magnitude of these libraries. In the Darul Hikmah library in Cairo, during the days of Al-Hakim Ba'amrillah, that's in the early part of the 11th century, it is said that it had 1.6 million volumes. In the Bayt al-Hikmah in Baghdad in the 8th century was also a huge library as well. In the library of Al-Hakam in Andalusia or Muslim Spain, there was something like 0.4 million volumes. The Bani Ammar library in Tripoli, which is now in Lebanon, there was as many as 1 million volumes and 180 copyists. Full-time copyist. So you're really talking about something that's far ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what has happened to these massive volumes of books? Are they still in existence, or what has been their fate?
Well, unfortunately, most of these treasures were either lost or ruined. And sometimes we hear about great works, voluminous works, only by their title, as they are referred to in some other secondary references. Well, there may be a few cases, one has to be objective on that, where some of the reasons of partial losses might be because of internal problems within the Muslim community itself. But by far, the greatest and most major losses of these treasures came because of extraneous or external forces. Just to give you a few examples of this, when the Hulagu and the Mongols attacked and invaded Baghdad, as you know, this was the most savage type of attack, they threw enough books and volumes in the Tigris River that was sufficient to make the river overflow and to constitute a bridge. See how wide and huge the river is? Was enough to make a bridge where knights used to go on the back of their horses back and forth from one end to the other. Historians say that for quite a long time, the waters in the Tigris River were blackened because of the amount of ink in the books that were dumped in the river. Similarly, during the Crusades, in the invasion of Syria, it is estimated that no less than 3 million volumes were destroyed by the Crusaders. In Andalusia or Muslim Spain, after the defeat of Muslims in Granada, it is said that nearly 1 million volumes were burned in one day by some religious fanatics who could not appreciate the sciences and knowledge that they could even themselves benefit from. There are also some narratives that in Sicily, a cardinal by the name of Zimons in the 15th century, in one day, he burned 80,000 volumes in a public square or main square of a city called Franda or Frande. And ironically, like Castorina mentions in her paper, this was about the same time when Columbus set to discover the Americas using Muslim calculations and Muslim compass. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, a great deal has been lost, but we still have quite a few that remained.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the evidence that we've been discussing in the last few programs really is overwhelming in terms of showing the remarkable contribution that Muslims have made to civilization. Many people who have been following this series, I'm sure, have been asking themselves, why more of this information isn't more widely known? Why are many of the inventions and discoveries that have been made by Muslims, why have these been attributed to others? What is your view of that?
Well, of course, there could be all kind of reasons. I'm not going to go in details, for example, addressing deliberate attempts to falsify facts of history. There may be cases of that. The cases where writers and propagandists and media try to present Islam as a nomadic religion, which is fit only for people of the desert, and that following Islam today means that you have to backtrack to the Middle Ages and live like people used to live in the Middle Ages, not even Middle Ages in the Islamic sense where they were bright civilization, but even in the European Dark Ages kind of conception. The motives vary. Some of these motives were colonial, some were missionary, some were even atheistic. All of them see in Islam some kind of danger to their own particular interests, and returning back to Islam also as a kind of a threat to their designs. But to talk about some other reasons which are even accepted by many non-Muslim historians, like Sarton, for example, he mentions that when the West matured enough to begin the Renaissance and to seek more knowledge, they followed three steps. One was to acquire Muslim knowledge. Secondly was to translate it from Arabic, which was the language of science and civilization, to other European languages. Mm-hmm. And he said in that stage, sometimes concealment took place and sometimes the works of Muslims were attributed to the translator. In the third stage, he says, this knowledge were then incorporated in the sources of or references in European languages. And he said again, many times the borrower, the one who borrowed from Muslim thought and Muslim contribution, was regarded or was dealt with as if he were the author of these works. And that's where some of these might have been deliberate, or some might have been just simply because of these mistakes in the transmission. But one can also refer as, for example, John Draper mentioned in the intellectual development and history of the intellectual development of Europe that sometimes fanaticism might be responsible for this concealment. I quote him, for example, in the second volume, in page 42, and he says, I have to deplore the systematic manner in which the literature of Europe has contrived to put out of sight our scientific obligation to the Mohammedans, a better term would have been Muslims. Surely they cannot be much longer hidden. Injustice founded on religious rancor and national conceit cannot be perpetuated forever. And that's, like I said, in a non-Muslim author who at least have some sense of fairness to recognize how these things have been hidden for too long. Similarly, I cannot all say that all writers were biased. Sarton, for example, mentioned that for 350 years, whenever he deals with one half century, seven periods, he said this is the time of, that is the most prominent scientist or scholar, and he mentioned Muslim names. So for seven periods or 350 years, the most prominent time were the times of Muslims. For 300 years subsequent to that, he says the time of so-and-so. So he mentioned three names, one of which is a Muslim name, a scholar. So that means that almost 650 years, there was either exclusive prominence or shared prominence in varieties of areas.
Well, in a word or two, we only have a minute or so left, I guess, in today's program. What would you consider to be the implications of this review of contributions?
Well, first of all, for Muslims, they should not really take it by way of boasting. Boasting is not a very mature thing. Nor should they take that by way of saying, all right, our ancestor contributed, so I don't have to do anything now, so enough what has been done. But I think the main point made here is to show in a practical, factual way how the teaching of the Quran that we mentioned early did really provide this impetus and inducement for progress and development in all areas, and to show that the decline of Muslims in later centuries, which is just beginning to change gradually now, is not because of Islam, but because of Muslims being not truly faithful to their faith. For non-Muslims, I think it might help provide some appreciation and mutual respect to rise above all this rancor and fanaticism, and perhaps develop a world where both can live together and benefit each other and contribute to a more humane civilization.
Thank you. We're getting frantic indications we should wrap. We want to thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Amen.